gambling in Havana. I took a little risk. 10 lawyers, guns, and money. Dead, get me out of this. Ha! And bystander, somehow I got stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I'm down on my luck. Yes, I'm down on my luck. Well, I'm down on my luck. Oh, it's been long. Guns and money. Huh. Yes. And lawyers, guns and money.
Hey, welcome to Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet. I'm your host, Frank Reardon. The show is brought to you by those 3,000 people from the Literary Underground. Tonight our guest is co-creator of Punk Hostage Press and writer himself, Razor. So let's just bring him on. Hello,
hey.
Are you there? Hey, what's
going
on?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Nice.
So how's it going, man? You at work or something?
It's going good. What's that?
Are you at work or something like that?
No, I just got done sanding the table, and I'm trying to... I actually came in here and tried to log on to Blog Talk, and it wouldn't let me on, so whatever.
Yeah, it can be a strange thing, that place. But, yeah, let's start. Your new book was released today?
Yeah, the print-on-demand version was available today for the first time. So,
go ahead.
We've been doing it is we do print-on-demand and then we also work with a printer here in Oakland, Amy Watson with 1984 Printing, and she prints up like a run of the books that's got a little bit more of the old school book design and like the art of bookmaking to it, offset type and all that. So
yeah.
you can get the print on the demand, pretty easy, 24/7 on the internet. Or, in a couple of weeks we'll have the nicer jacketed version from 1984 Printing available as well.
That's cool, because I know there's quite a few people that publishers now, to keep themselves afloat, that use the POD. I know that New York Quarterly Books uses it and a few other presses. I mean, it's not like... Neopoesis, the one I do, sometimes is used POD, and they, not always, but sometimes, and they have some company somewhere in the South, I think, and they do a pretty good job, so it's not like a bad thing, like I don't think it is.
Yeah, it's not that it's bad. I think the main thing, when me and Iris made the commitment back in February to start doing this, we really wanted to do it in a way that, that has an integrity to our experience. We both kind of started writing in Los Angeles around the same time and, about a little over 30 years ago. And so we both kind of had there was a bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard that was a crucial kind of learning place for both of us. And it was Baroque Books. Right across the street from Musso and Frank's on Hollywood, and it was kind of, a cool place to go if you were, you know, a youngster and you were out in the street and you liked to read and, you know, the library didn't have everything you wanted. So it was good to go into Baroque Books. And the guy who owned it, Red Stolarovsky, was a pretty amazing guy. Big influence on me, you know, easily, you know, someone who guided me toward different books and stuff and you know, had a huge wealth of experience with publishing, like, you know, going back to the pre-war eras and selling books. And, you know, he was like one of the true old, you know, book peddler guys that really kind of kept books alive in America. And we just wanted to really make sure that we did something that was true to that experience, you know, that, like, that we're putting books out that reflect where we first, like, we're given books by somebody, you know. Because it's not just a press, really. We're starting a nonprofit, and our hope is to, you know, do I've been involved in doing a poetry in prison panels and creative writing workshops at homeless shelters, and, you know, I teach a creative writing thing at in a program that's for homeless people in West Oakland. And, you know, it's just really a big part of what I do now and what Iris does. Iris goes into women's shelters, and she's going to start going into the women's jail in L.A. And we want to be able to bring books and creative writing experiences to people who are in those situations, because we have both been in those situations. And, you know, literature and writing, and, you know, contemporary literature especially, was like something that was a big part of why we survived those situations.
Yeah, that's a really cool thing, because I was just going to say, for the listeners that might not know who you are, like, for myself that was in trouble with some of those things you mentioned, you guys wanted to start that because in a way of giving back, because it helped you? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, definitely. When I first came into Baroque Books on Hollywood Boulevard, I was kind of a homeless, you know, kid who's involved in some criminal activity and, you know, living day to day. And Hollywood was pretty kind of mangy back then. It was like, you know, it wasn't like it's cleaned up as it is now. And you know, it was just being able to hang out in the bookstore, and Red would let me, like, you know, clean up and stack books and sweep out the bookstore, you know, in exchange for books, because I didn't have money. And when I would, you know, I would sell drugs. I sold weed and other stuff a lot around the strip there. And whenever I would make a little bit of money, I would go into his bookstore, and kind of my way of paying back his kindness would be to buy books. And that began this relationship with books. And, you know, I eventually would become an adult that would get put into prison, and reading and writing was a big part of how I made it through that experience. And it's a huge part of why I'm still here today. So, you know, I just want to share that, you know, and give back to, like, you know, books and literature, because it was so crucial for me.
It's definitely a different thing to do amongst writing, which can be a very selfish endeavor and actually carry over into some people's lives as a selfish thing. So I commend you guys on trying to start doing something like that. But why don't you give us a piece from one of your new book that's coming out? I've read the title and stuff, but you can present it, like, the title and stuff, to people who might not know you.
Oh, yeah. The book that just came out is called Better Than a Gun in a Knife Fight. And it's actually a book that I began working on about when last time I was locked up, when I got out, you know, about a little over 5 years ago. And I was still on parole, and I was really kind of struggling, and there was a few people that, you know, one of the first people that kind of helped me out was Bucky Sinister, because I was, you know, I got out up here in Northern California in the Bay Area, and I had to do a program and, like, you know, have a parole officer, and I was in a pretty stringent kind of controlled environment as far as how I could behave. And, you know, Bucky was cool enough to, you know, help me out, gave me a couple books, and I had known him for years before that, but, you know, he was kind of just like pointing me in the right direction and, you know, and he believed in my writing. He was like, you should get back to your writing. So he kind of encouraged me to get back to that because I hadn't published in years. I hadn't published since 95, and I'd kind of like just gone into like a little black hole of and I mean, even when that chapbook came out in 95, I was like really not around. You know, the guy who was publishing it was handling everything, and I was kind of checked out. And so this book has been like a 5-year kind of project that I've been putting together. And about 4 years ago, Iris kind of started helping me with editing. And we originally intended to publish it with Luis Rodriguez on Pia Chucha Press, but I have another project that I'm hoping to work with Luis on. So I kind of put this on the back burner for a while, and you know, it just kind of was something when we decided to put a press together in February. Iris was like, you know, I want to put that book together, and she had edited it. She'd spent a lot of time with it. It was like a lot of pages. So, you know, I was like, all right, you know, I want to do it too. And so it was kind of a 5-year process to get this book finally to where it saw the light of day. And so, it's, you know, it was a good feeling today to kind of be able to like put it out there where people could buy it, and people started buying it. And that was a real good feeling too. I haven't really sold a book in like 17, 18 years.
Okay. Do you want to get us a piece there? Or?
Yeah, you want me to read something from it instead of talking?
No, yeah, you can read a piece if you want.
More work, less bullshit. I'm just kind of flipping through it right now. I mean, all I've got is the galley proof, so I still don't have like the actual printed one. The people that bought books today are actually going to get a printed version of this before I do. I'll just read. This is kind of like one that I wrote. It's just called Razor. And it's kind of about, like, how I got the name and what the name means to me. A young boy in a troubled place became a man by violent ritual one day. And the next night, he earned a name by his prodigious use of a simple tool. As he pushed the envelope of a boy becoming a man, he reinforced it. It being the meaning of the name. It being the use of the name. His own name connected him to things that he wanted to obscure. His name at birth had been changed by process, calamity, marriage, and adoption. He had quickly learned painful lessons about the arbitrary rules of violent contraband. He had quickly developed a taste for entertainment that came under the dangerous scrutiny. He had quickly learned traditions and regulations of conduct in order to maintain a semblance of balance in a world of chaos clustered by geographic, socioeconomic, bloodline quarrels into groups of alliances and obstacles that he navigated in and out of, parties, places to get high, places to play games, places to fuck, places to make music, places to find shelter in the middle of it all. In these places, he found a sanctified peace amidst all the turmoil. As he read words of various meaning, as he read words of various craft and significance, as he wrote words that were all inspired in part by the words he was always reading, the music he was always playing, the way he tried to live and love, the way he tried to make a living. While he waited and watched on all the dying, the way he was becoming more of a man, less of a boy with each word, that measured the distance between the two. He kept at the writing and kept at the writing until one day it bled into everything else he was doing. So he shared the writing as a way to further his agenda with a woman, and the words began to act out of their own volition and share themselves in quantitative leaps and bounds until he was not sure what to do about the condition of it all. And he surrendered to it for a while. Then, as things seemed to shift, he withdrew from it all for a long time. And then as it all shifted again, he began to share it all again. Except his demeanor had changed, and his age had worn him down. He never really cared what people called him. It was how they said it that bothered him. It was who they were that bothered him, what they did for a living, the rules and regulations they followed, the commitment or the lack thereof to any change they exhibited in their actions, the humility they may or may not exhibit in their words, the lack of faith they showed in the truth, the lack of truth they showed in their faith. He had his own hypocrisy to deal with. He did not want to deal with other people's on top of it. He felt he had dealt with it enough when he had no choice. If the choice was his, then it would be his fault alone. If he continued to deal, and if he dealt with other people's hypocrisy, how would he ever find freedom for his own? What name would he own the most? What name would own him the most? What would you want to call him after all was said and done? Most of the years that had passed, he had hoped most people would choke on it when they pronounced the name he had earned. It had nothing to do with an image or to promote his writing. It was for the family, friends, and lovers he had buried. It was for the way the world had tried to bury him over and over again. It was for the times of torture at the hands of the state. It was for the time away from family while he ran for his life, anonymous, with only that name to go by, year after year, day in and day out, all through every night in between. He was tired now, restless, in the peace of surviving it all. But he would never forget the way it felt to cut a person's throat when they called you out of your name.
Wow, man. That's like, I remember how I think that I discovered you, obviously, I think probably through the internet. And you have these, like, this great knack of words, and, like, you're very prolific. Like, there's not a lot of, and I admire that a lot because I write probably at the same pace as you do in many ways. Like, not the same stuff, but, like, prolific, like, a lot. And I met you for the first time in L.A. like a couple of years ago with Essay, and I think I discovered you through Essay and maybe Scott Wahnberg. And who are those? Did those guys have like an influence on you as a writer coming up?
Definitely. Because like, I mean, I went to my first reading when I was younger at this place called the Laza Club, and it was like kind of as that poem or prose piece, you know, which is very autobiographical, as it says. It was like I was playing in a punk rock band, and I was living in kind of a squat. And this girl was telling me that she thought I was a poet. And, you know, it seemed like a pretty good hustle because I liked her. And so I was like, well, sure, you know. And she's like, we're doing this reading over at this place, you know, and you should come by and read your stuff. And I just kind of acted like, yeah, sure, you know, as if I did it all the time. And it was my first read, so showed up, and it was, you know, I'll never forget it because, like, the featured reader was Wanda Coleman. And it was, you know, I mean, there was a bunch of really fucking kick-ass people there who knew what the hell they were doing. And, you know, and it was like I was just out. I mean, I was, you know, I was really nervous. And I obviously was not going to get any ass that night either. So it was just kind of like this thing. But I did get up and I read this one poem real quick, and then I left. You know, I got up, I read it, and I left. And I had to, like, drink a 40 to get the courage up. And, you know, and it was like the open part after the feature. And I was so overwhelmed, and I just, like, fucking got up, read the poem, and split. And it was that scene of people, you know, I mean, that experience was really intense that night. So I kind of kept going back, you know. I would, a couple of months would go by, I'd hear about another reading, and I'd show up again. And then I started, like, consciously writing things. And I started reading, you know, a lot of different writers that wrote that way, and I started to kind of get it. And it, you know, just started, it was kind of like I was bit, I was hooked. But the problem was, is I felt like an outsider a lot. And when I saw S.A. and Scott and those guys do their thing, you know, I would be pretty intimidated. But, you know, I just was definitely in awe of how they could come into a reading and take the stage and just riff and do stuff and entertain people and, like, do all that stuff. That wasn't really, like, my style. My strength wasn't in my performance, you know, and I've never really considered myself a performance poet. But, you know, there's some performance poets that I've met that I really admire. And, you know, and definitely S.A. is one of them. He's really influenced me for years. So, you know, to finally kind of, you know, once I got out, like I was saying, Bucky helped me a lot. And Bucky also kind of was like, why don't you call S.A., why don't you call Iris? And I wouldn't have done it if Bucky hadn't have told me to, and I contacted them. And it was just like, everyone was so cool to me. They were like, oh, yeah, you know, we'll help you out. We'll help you get your writing together. You should have a book and stuff like that. And, you know, S.A. Griffin is definitely, you know, he's done that for so many people. He's, like, helped so many people, like, who are really brilliant writers, who have, like, a really strong outside voice, get, you know, kind of get a book together. And like, you know, I know he did it for Tony Sabella in a way that was, you know, crucial. Like Tony Sabella's past, but, you know, we wouldn't have some of the stuff that Tony has left us if it wasn't for S.A. kind of, you know, helping Tony get it down. And you know, and Scott Wanneberg is just like, has always just been this giant Buddha of love, you know. Like, I was going to Dutton's when he worked there, and, you know, that guy, he was just always cool to me. He was never, like, had an attitude or an ego. Like, he taught me so much about not having, you know, because I had a really bad attitude and a really bad ego when I was younger. And watching that dude and how he got down really made it okay for me to just, like, let go of that shit and to, like, just really not judge people for what they were writing or where they were from, but just, like, the fact that they were writing, you know. And that's it, just that simple, that they're doing the dance, you know, singing the song and doing the dance, as Scott would say.
Okay, why don't you give us another piece of your choice? It doesn't have to be from the book, it can be if you want it to be.
Yeah, that was a long one. I'm gonna read one. This was, I don't know, I've read that before. I read this a couple of times, and I don't like to read anything unless people really ask for it, like, over, more than once. I'm kind of like that. Like, I don't read a lot, and when I do read, it's like I usually write stuff for the reading, and I read it that one time, and that's it. But this is a piece about a woman that I met in San Francisco. I traveled around a lot in the 80s and 90s, and met a lot of amazing writers all around the world. And this woman, like, really touched me, and we kind of had a thing for a minute. And, you know, she passed away. And there's a collection of her writing that's out on Manic Deep Press. It's pretty amazing. Book called Some Angels Wear Black, and her name's Eli Coppola. So this was a poem that I wrote when I got out of prison, when I was thinking about her, when that collection of her poetry came out. And it's just called Eli. Fierceness in the eyes, piercing into mine with an honest gaze. She talks soft with an emphasis on fragility in awkward moments. We share with some medicine to calm both of our illness, but cure nothing in between us. We talk words and writers till early in the morning. She says she is finally tired enough to sleep, in spite of the pain. So I leave her a big bud and give her a big kiss. Goodbye. As I roll out into the early morning cruise down to 16th and Mission. I feel like a coward as I cook up a shot in the Yula Hotel, and I count every step it takes to climb up to her place as the dope runs into my heavy mind and it all gets a little tighter for a moment. And I have to hope that her condition will change, but it never does. Getting up to her pad gets harder and harder for her. Then for me, regret is not so bad by the balloon, or remorse so effective by the spoonful. She invites me over, and I lie sometimes when I am weakest, and she never seems to care. But I know who I am, and I drink to her when she passes, and the whiskey tastes like acid, and it burns a memory into my guts of what I could have been, what I should have done, but didn't. Crying as I hung up the phone instead, her memorial is the beauty of her words that I feel so undeserving of. She never left me without a smile, always told me what was on her mind. She spit in the face of demons that I ran from. I kissed the mouths of the angels that cloaked her. They held her so tight that she could not walk away. Not walk away from a fate that was never a deterrence to her spirit. She loved Skid Row poets and donut shops late at night. She loved music that you could dance to and songs that were sung off key with a wink and a sparkle in those doe-like eyes. She loved me even though I could not love myself enough to give her love back when she asked for it. Never demanded it, so I went where angels looked away to get her voice out of my head, because her kindness seemed wasted on my broken life. She left a hole that wings won't let her walk back through. After a decade away from this, she still enters my thoughts. She tells me cool words arranged like staccato messengers and delivered with proud timpani rhythms that beat as I bring her back to life in dreams and listen to her ask for a joint, but if not that, maybe a cigarette. She is the smoking angel of my memory that puts ashes in my eyes. I still love her madly for her passion that she injected into my heart like hot heroin that I craved to quell the riots of fear that she was never afraid of as she brushed my matted hair away from my temple and hushed me in her shaking arms. We spilled wine and laughed, and she never judged me or ignored me in crowded bars of drunk poets or from across a pillow we shared for the night. She made the most inappropriate jokes about crutches and sex as we lay naked together in the clean softness of her bedding. When she died from a failed heart, it broke mine in a silent hidden spot that no one ever saw until today, when the words named it and I cried her name out loud and alone. Then I smiled as I felt her coo back from the darkness, and my fears were hushed once again. I never lose her words or the place where our souls touched. She is there in the sunrise, on her street looking out over China Basin as it glints like mother of pearl at the start of another San Francisco day. Another day without her struggling to tell me something, with me hearing nothing but the song in her voice that is a song of simple love, a song of simple friendship, a song of simple kindness. She tells me without struggle in my best dreams, where she makes deals with an afterlife that I won't have alone, not if she can help it.
That was amazing. But it reminds me of conversations that we've had, like via the email or something, and when we have these like colossal conversations about like books and things like that, and it's obvious that you have like great influence of like, you know, your street poets and your Fontes and Bukowski, but there's always like this touch in it that like of other influences that you can hear. Like, I don't know, like recently you were telling me you were reading Robert Creeley or stuff that's so like opposite of your experience in some ways that, that like a lot of, I think the younger poets coming up or writers or whatever have you miss out on like some of the beauty that would be in like a Creeley or a Charles Olson or someone like that. And I don't know, care to elaborate?
Well, yeah, I mean, like I said, I traveled a lot. I mean, I kind of just read Soldotsky was like pretty good friends with Bukowski. I mean, I don't know if Luke had a lot of friends, you know, like, I don't think he had any friends like Red. And, you know, Red had all his books in the store there. So that's where I got introduced to Bukowski's writing. And it was amazing because, like, Bukowski's writing for someone my age in that time, it, like, made it all right for me to write whatever. It, like, gave me permission to write, like, all these different things I was feeling down that I don't think I would have felt like I could have written without reading him first. But, you know, moving out from there and traveling around, going to New York City and where I was born and living there again and, like, you know, meeting writers there that really influenced me, Jim Carroll really influenced me, and then going to the place where Jim Carroll kind of got, you know, cleaned up off heroin and, like, really became a different writer. You know, Bolinas, California, a really influential place on me. And that going to Bolinas was where I really got introduced to a lot of, you know, because Creeley had lived there for a long time and Berrigan had stayed out there. And, you know, for a few years at one point, the Paris Review was edited out of there. And, like, you know, Richard Brodigan had committed suicide there. And you know, there was that influence there, and I picked up a lot of their books out there, and it was, you know, just being out there, kind of out of the city for a change, it was transformative to, you know, read different writers and experience, like, different stuff, you know, and, like, I don't know, I've really, like, been lucky to have not been closed to a lot of different literary experiences over the years. So, you know, all of that feeds into it. And really that's what this book is about. It's about, I'm reflecting, there's no one style that I'm going with. I'm basically reflecting, like, as much as I can, all the different influences on my writing in 30 years. So it's like, you know, I really try to, like, I think a good writer always tries to honor their influences as much as possible to make up for the stealing that they do. And, you know, because that's what we do, you know. If you're going to start as a writer, when I started as a writer, I just stole. I think the first shit I stole was from Edgar Allan Poe, and it just kind of, you know. And then when I was a teenager, I started stealing from Langston Hughes because I wanted to sound like I was really fucking cool. And, you know, and then Bukowski, I stole from him, and you know, Wanda Coleman, you know, I definitely stole from her that night. Like, I mean, you know, we're thieves, but we can be thieves with honor if, as long as we take what we steal and we write from our heart and, like, give it back. That's just kind of, like, the best way I can think of putting it.
So we're rolling down to about 11 minutes, and thus far the Punk Hostage Press has published Danny Baker's book, and yours is on the roll, and Iris's, and so
yeah,
you're going
Iris's will be coming next month, The Daughters of Bastards, and Fractured Danny's. I got the edit Danny's. Iris edited mine, and then I'm going to, you know, edit hers. And then there's a book after that from Pleasant Gaiman, who's been a writing partner of Iris's for a long time. They were in the Ringling Sisters together, and they got a pretty rich history together. So we're going to publish Pleasant's book. We got a book. We're lining, you know, we got a few people who are lined up to come out on the press. They're working on manuscripts, trying to work with a lot of different people. You know, there's Dennis and Annette Cruz are are two amazing LA writers over the years that like really speak to that Chicano experience of Los Angeles and the melding of cultures that LA is, that, you know, is what really formed me growing up in that experience. And, you know, we got Eduardo Jones, who's out in Brooklyn right now, putting a thing together. You know, I'm hoping that you're putting something together, Frank.
Yeah, I'm 11 pages in, man, so you're going to have to wait till the end of the year before it's done.
Which is all, you know, and which is all good, you know, like that. In the next year, we're going to map out a bunch of books. I talked to Diana Rose about putting a manuscript together. You know, Debbie Kirk's got one that I'm about to start editing as soon as I'm done with Iris's. You know, so an essay, you know, S.A. Griffin and me have been working on a haiku book of mine, and I'm hoping
awesome.
That the turnaround on that is S.A. is going to put a book on her press. So, you know, it's like, it's just like a lot of, you know, a lot of people have come to us with manuscripts that we know, and we're also going to be putting out a bunch of creative nonfiction stuff, and we're also going to be putting out some stuff, you know, stuff for people who are struggling, you know, kind of, you know, stuff for you know, kind of like, you know, like what Murphy Clamrod just got done doing with Unadorned, you know, that anti-violence thing, which, you know, is pretty amazing, and that's an amazing collection. You know, that's the same type of stuff that we want to do. And there's so many people that are like-minded that are doing stuff like that right now. You know, so there's so many other people that have contacted me, and we're just really hopeful that we're going to be putting out, you know, 8 to 10 books a year for the next couple of years. And, you know, it's just, we don't have any money, but we just kind of have a lot of faith that somehow, because we're doing the right thing, it's going to work.
It's sounds like a good idea, and you guys are headed out before the big Oakland, San Francisco shindig. You and Iris are hitting out some dates out there on the West Coast.
Yeah, we're gonna kind of just cruise up the coast and you know, hit spots in Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and a spot that is kind of special for both of us is like the Henry Miller Library in Big Sur. So we're gonna do something there, and you know, Monterey, Santa Cruz, and then we're going to have a big barbecue at my place in Point Richmond on Friday before the thing goes down. I'm hoping you're going to come out, right?
Yeah, I'm going to be there.
Yeah, so we're going to have like a real informal barbecue and go over to, we're going to go to the bar down the street and just have like an old school salon kind of reading, you know, where everyone just like gets up and reads. You know, nobody's tripping, no fucking list that you got to put your name on. You just get up and read, you know, just catch the vibe and do it.
Sounds good. So you got a shorter piece to close us out with. We've got about 5.5 minutes.
Yeah, I'll do something real short. This is something also from Better Than a Gun Knife Fight, and it's a poem I wrote for Scott when this was while he was still alive. And, you know, this is something I wrote for him. And, you know, just because he's kind of always been this guy for me. So this is just called Scott. Every time I find that dark side of the road and I think I'm done for, this is going to be it. Sorry, I got attacked by a dog.
That's all right.
I'm going to have to start over again. My old lady's dog almost wanted to kill me for reading poetry. little mini pen. So I'll start over again. This is for Scott. Every time I find that dark side of the road and I think I'm done for, this is going to be it. Sputtering my last tears and breathing my last words. It's almost done for good. Then, like magic, your headlights appear in the distance between us. They pull over onto the shoulder. for I am certain I am dying my last lyrical death in this maddening world of miscommunications, parading as near misses. All I can hear in that final moment is the sound of the crackling gravel words as they are getting closer. The headlights shine brighter. The crackling gravel words under your tires sing me the song of my salvation as I return to the blacktop, riding free once more.
Yeah. I sure missed that bastard. I don't know. So where can where can everybody get? Oh, sorry.
I was just gonna say he left a big hole in the world when he left. You know.
Yeah, he did, man. I miss that guy. I miss his phone calls. I miss seeing him. He was a great guy. Where can everybody that doesn't know go to get your book that's out, or Danny Baker's, or anybody who's interested in future projects?
People can go to punkhostagepress.com. You can, you know, I'm on Facebook. I have a page, a Razor page, and there's a Punk Hostage page. You can friend us and message us. You know, we got a blog spot. There's myriad of internet technology ways to contact us. We also have a P.O. box in Hollywood that's you can write to. It's Punk Hostage Press, P.O. Box 1869. Hollywood, California, 90078. And, you know, just, like, look for us out there, because we're going to try, like I said, we're really kind of determined to, you know, like, do our part to put literature back into the world and books back into the hands of people that want to read them.
Awesome, man. Well, it's rolling down to, like, the last minute here, but I wanted to say thanks for coming on and sharing your awesome shit with us and awesome stories, and I don't know, man, I'll be seeing you in like a month and a half.
Yeah, man, I look forward to it. About a month from now, and it'll be nice. You know, a lot of folks be coming to the Bay, and it'll just be a real nice experience, because, you know, Iris's book will be out then, so we're kind of looking at it as like the real true kickoff. You know, both of us will finally have our books out on our press, and, you know, we're kind of hoping maybe Danny will make an appearance, and, you know, if not, you know, we're definitely going to plan more stuff in the coming year. We're going to try to get out to the East Coast next year, or in the fall, and see a bunch of folks out there that we haven't seen in a while. So we're definitely going to be on the road soon, and, you know, like I said, we're all over the internet. Just look for the Punk Hostage Press thing.
Well, it's awesome, man. I don't know. I'll be talking to you, I guess. The lady just told me she's cutting off.
All right. Yeah.
All right, man. See you around.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Frank, for having me.
Nope. No problem. That was A Razor. You hear about how to get all his stuff. Contact me, contact him, Facebook, you know. Next week's guest is Kansas City writer Iris Applequist. You don't want to miss that show. What the hell ever.